Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
The Philosophy of Sex.
Welcome to The Philosophy of Sex. I'm Caroline Moreau Hammond. Every now and again, you have the unexpected privilege of experiencing something that moves you, be it a book, a piece of art, or music. Something about it expands and challenges your beliefs. Today's guest, Dr. Javier Sekidopoulou, is the author of a book that moved me profoundly. In Sexuality Beyond Consent, Risk, Race, and Traumatophilia, Javier maintains that society has become overly focused on healing trauma, and needs to reroute its attention to what subjects do with their trauma. She calls attention to a series of challenging questions, like why is sexuality beyond consent worth risking? And how does risk become a way of engaging with the opaque parts of ourselves? And in what ways does eliminating risk remove the potential for erotic transformation? I loved many things about this book. It's intentionally provocative and cuttingly critiques status quo ideas about controversial topics of child sexuality, trauma, and sadism. Javier draws unexpected links between ideas that are so often seen at odds with one another, like cruelty and care, sadism and ethics, trauma and expansion, and perversion and purity. Javier writes about ideas typically relegated to the morbid, dark, and unspeakable, and sheds light on their potentially transformative powers, something she refers to as erotic astonishment. Blending philosophy, queer theory, and race theory with her extensive experience and practice as an analyst, she proposes that accepting the strange within, not to master trauma but to rub up against it, may open people up to encounters with the enigmatic, astounding, and to unique forms of care. Javier trained at the New York University postdoctoral program in psychotherapy and psychoanalysis, where she now teaches psychosexuality and polymorphous perversity. Javier is also on the faculty of a number of prestigious psychoanalytic institutes in the United States. In her book and in this interview, she shares the experiences of her patients that are shocking and touching in equal measure. The book is a risk in and of itself, and is written for those willing to experience risk. As such, please be aware Javier and I discuss a range of taboo topics, including rape fantasy, race play, piss play, BDSM, and sexual violence. This is a slightly longer interview than we usually release, because there's a lot contained within it. Javier is simply brilliant. Please enjoy our conversation. So where I would like to start, I guess, is with infantile sexuality, because I feel like that lays the foundation for a lot of what kind of follows in the book. So can you explain in as relatively simplistic terms as possible what infantile sexuality is and where the ideas behind it have emerged from?
It's really a very central concept in the book, so it's good to start there. The notion of infantile sexuality, I should say, first of all, it's a term, it's a psychoanalytic term, and it comes from Freud. And Freud, in trying to think about sexuality, came up with an idea that he revised multiple times throughout his life. But the basic concept behind it is that children are not just not sexually innocent, but that there is a sexuality that we have from the start, and that that sexuality is not about sexual contact per se, but that it's about an internal state that has several characteristics. And those characteristics are that infantile sexuality is ontologically perverse, meaning that it has to do with all kinds of energies and interests that eventually will get, as we mature and grow up, Freud said, will mostly get cleaned out of sexuality, like mm-hmm. as one becomes, in his mind, ideally heterosexual, and sex becomes about procreation, an idea that has been very heavily critiqued, obviously. But he started out with this notion that there's something extremely effervescent and very wide and very expansive about sexuality. And that infantile sexuality had some very particular features. It's not about being connected with somebody. It's not about being close to somebody. It's not even about necessarily about kind of like reaching some pleasure like orgasm does, but it has a very strange economy. It's about experiencing more and more things and things intensifying even to the point of exhaustion. It has to do with the wish to look or to be looked at, or masochism or sadism or all kinds of like weird things. It's not even localized in any part of the body. And one might say, really, like children care about that? And that's not exactly what he meant by infantile sexuality, or the way that we use it. And I use it in the book is to talk about a kind of sexuality that never gets disciplined out of us, that remains with us for the rest of our lives, independently of what your sexual orientation is, or what your gender is, or what your way of having sex is, that this is always a kind of like something that vibrates in the background and that sometimes comes to the foreground. So infantile sexuality is mostly about that.
Can you give an example to, I guess, help contextualize that for people?
So what we in psychoanalysis call the infantile sexual like manifests in a variety of different contexts, like, you know, not just in sexual life in terms of like how somebody likes to have sex, but in actually it inflects every aspect of human experience. And it's not necessarily always a good thing or a bad thing. So for example, like if you think about the invasion of the Capitol on January 6th, you could say, oh, these are people who are out of control, who are trying kind of like it's an attempted coup. But part of what you also see, if you pay attention to these people's faces, is that they're flushed and there's a lot of excitement about what's happening and a sense of about triumph. And somebody walks into the Capitol and defecates on somebody's desk. And you would think, oh, how uncivilized, like these people are out of control. But one could also say this is one malignant version, not all versions of it are malignant, one particularly malignant version of something that is very infant, very erotic, sexual, in the sense of like having that energy of like intensity and passion and feeling extremely entitled to having, to taking, to grasping, to possessing, the cruelty of it, the violence of it. We don't usually think of these states as being libidinal states, but they are. If you're thinking with infantile sexuality, the fact that somebody would go and like defecate on somebody's desk is not surprising anymore. All of a sudden, it makes a lot of sense, even though kind of like in rational life and in terms of how we think about how people function, this does not make sense. But it gives you a way of understanding these kinds of experiences, some of which are extremely destructive and some of which are not.
Yeah, I mean, in the book, you talk about Freud's ideas of certain aspects of sexuality, like sadism or masochism or some of the drives that you're kind of pointing to there being endemic to sexuality as opposed to a deviation from that. And I loved that idea and the way that you articulated that. So how does infantile sexuality then relate to sort of perversion in adult life?
That is one of the ways in which kind of like it comes up in a non-malignant way. So infantile sexuality kind of like underwrites all aspects of human functioning, but it specifically easily syndicates with the erotic. So there are so many theories in psychoanalysis advocating for a certain kind of like what we think about health or in everyday life, what we think about being a healthy sexual relationship. But thinking with infantile sexuality also permits us to see that there are many ways in which erotic experience manifests, that it plays out in domains that are that one would think are unexpected, like masochism and sadism, which Freud says are two of the most important aspects of infantile sexuality. So this gives us a way to be able to enter conversations about sexual experiences that actually do not follow the usual trajectory of how we think about sex, and add something about the drivenness of experience. So the sexual drive is very much about, is very much infiltrated by these kinds of forces.
And I mean, one thing that is very clear in the book is that you're willing to hold space for the expansiveness of that. When did you kind of become curious about more expansive sexual practices, or what was it in you that you think has driven you towards thinking about sex in this more expansive way?
Mm-hmm. Well, I would say more expansive, but also more difficult, because there are several examples that I work with in sexuality beyond consent that are quite challenging. They're not just kind of like thrilling extensions of how we think about sexual life, but also locate the erotic in relation to trauma in ways that can be quite challenging to think about. And, you know, I should say I'm a clinical psychoanalyst. I talk and listen to people for kind of like as part of my everyday experience. And it's, you know, when my job is very particular, it's very interesting and it's extremely intimate in unusual ways. People talk to me about all kinds of things that don't come up in everyday conversation or even with intimates. And that is a tremendous privilege. And what that also means is that I get to hear about the sorts of kind of like less openly discussed range of experiences that people have, including fringe sexual interests or fetishes. So I work a lot with the queer community and hear a lot about those kinds of experiences from patients. And I have been wanting to write and speak more openly about the difficulties, about how difficult it is to think about these things outside of pathology, outside of just repetition. And in my explorations, in thinking about sexuality, I also came to discover something which now seems obvious to me, but it took some time to be able to articulate and flesh out, which is that that there's a particular proximity between sexuality and trauma, which may feel startling, certainly unexpected for most people.
It's sort of once you confront it, it seems sort of true and accurate, but it's actually allowing yourself to get to that point, I think, it's an interesting hurdle. And I mean, obviously you take a pretty non-normative view of how trauma should be approached or dealt with, not just in a psychoanalytic context, but also sort of at a wider social level. So could you explain sort of your view around the cultural landscape surrounding trauma? There's a quote at the top of, at the start of the book, culture is the precaution of those who claim to think thought, but who steer clear of its chaotic journey. And I loved that because I feel like it sums it up so beautifully. But if you could provide your summation, that would be great.
Sure. So in my field, one would think that a psychoanalyst and somebody who works with people trying to help people who are in pain, one of the very dominant models in my field is the idea of trying to cure trauma. Now, to be fair, no clinician in their right mind believes that trauma can be cured per se. We all know that trauma changes you. But the way that we are trained, the way that we train our colleagues, and the way we sit with patients are premised on this idea that if you do good work and the patient is committed and the treatment goes deep enough, trauma can be worked through. And the most common metaphor for this comes from the work of a psychoanalyst called Hans Lowold, who says that the goal of clinical work is to turn ghosts into ancestors, meaning that they're still there, you know that things happened, they've affected you, but they're not kind of like creeping up on you. They are kind of like more organized, sitting in the background, informing your life, but not quite informing your history, part of your history, but not quite startling you with their presence. But the truth is that this is not how trauma works. And I think it's time for us to move away from this very powerful psychoanalytic and I think also cultural fiction, that there is a way to take something traumatic and turn it into something that is just, and I'm going to say this in a somewhat provocative way, just encyclopedically registered and historically recorded, but no longer eruptive in one's psychic life. In fact, if anything, part of what we are learning through the Me Too movement and the kind of like the gains that have been made around consent and kind of like pushing back against violation is that how you're going to be triggered or what gets activated in the encounter with another person cannot be anticipated ahead of time. However well you're feeling at any one particular moment, however good the treatment you've received. And the other, so I've come to describe this approach to trauma of imagining that it can be healed, or more generally, the tendency to want to make trauma disappear as traumatophobic. And I'm arguing instead that, in fact, we're drawn back to the sites of our traumatic experiences, that we're drawn to touching our wounds, to trying to pick at them, to trying to kind of like scratch the scabs that they have left behind. We want to touch our injuries. And that is part of human experience, and it's part of how kind of like we not only feel alive, but also feel present in ourselves. And I call that juxtaposing it with traumatophobia, I call it traumatophilia, to talk about to contrast the fear of approaching something that has been difficult with the affinities, the natural affinities and the forces of attraction to that which has wounded us.
Mm. So how would, I mean, one thing you hear about a lot now is sort of the idea of a trauma-informed therapist or a trauma-informed yoga teacher or, you know, whatever area it might be in. And I've always found that to be somewhat of like a contradictory concept, right? The idea that the person holding space would be able to anticipate what might trigger trauma for someone. So how would that, the idea of being trauma-informed, sort of sit within the framework of traumatophilia and traumatophobia?
Yeah, well, it wouldn't. That's the whole point, that there are now developing, I would call them industries, because these are very neoliberal practices, kind of like very much plugged into the capitalism of therapy, turned into a product that is sold to us with all kinds of promises about what it can deliver, promises that it cannot fulfill, but which are made anyway, and are made, I think, by very kind of like well-meaning clinicians too, who are also buying into the idea that trauma can be healed, or the notion of reparations, as if anything can ever be repaired, as if trauma is not ongoing, as if the kinds of social ills that have created the need for reparations have been fixed, and all we need to do is just let the wound heal, when in fact racism and misogyny and transphobia are ongoing and rampant in our world today. So there is on the, this I think unwarranted optimism, which borders on, I think delusion, that there's a way to extract human pain from the psyche. And that anybody who is engaged with their pain in some particular ways is necessarily pathological. And what I mean by some ways is kind of like I'm speaking about sex, because we have many, many examples of artists, for example, being engaged with their trauma to produce art, to produce a beautiful painting or a poem. And there we appreciate finding trauma in creative expression. But somebody who is having like sexual encounters around traumatic experiences, or who organizes their erotic lives in the grammar of some experiences that have been wounding, is likely to be seen very differently. So the question becomes like, how is it that we are welcoming of trauma that we encounter in some organized form like in the as a short story, as a novel, as a piece of music that was inspired by somebody's experience of war or somebody's experience of having been violated. So we are comfortable finding it there, but pathologize it when we find it in the domain of the intimate. So in the book, I work with a couple of different works of art that is very, very difficult art and very provocative, challenging. And it is art that I have come to call somewhat sadistic, in fact, ethically sadistic, because it requires you, if you're going to engage with it, you are required to step out of how you think things work, how we have been told things work around in one case, erotic relationships vis-a-vis racial trauma, and in the other case, in terms of the Holocaust trauma vis-a-vis the erotic. And you have to do some thinking for yourself that goes outside the lines of how we tend to see trauma working.
Yeah, I want to revisit slave play a little bit later. But I think, yeah, what you're pointing to there is very interesting, that we've sort of created these domains in which there's appropriateness for trauma in one context and not another, or when it can be wielded or not wielded, or who can wield it and who can't wield it. There's quite strong sort of social constructs around that now. And would that fall into the area of being traumatophobic?
Yes. Yeah. Absolutely, which may sound paradoxical, because kind of like these would be all instances of being quite preoccupied with trauma. So what I call traumatophobic is not the tendency to like not think about trauma, but to the contrary, the ways in which we are transfixed with a discourse around eliminating trauma. And I work with a lot of Black feminisms, a variety of different Black feminisms in the book to show that this notion of a subject, of this fantasy, that there is an intactness to our being from which trauma interrupts and to which we will hopefully can be delivered back to if we receive the right treatment, the right intervention, the right analytic, in psychoanalysis, certainly there's a lot of talk about that, and not just in psychoanalysis, as you were pointing out, that there's a way to drain that from the psyche. So one of the questions that we may want to ask is, whose fantasy is it that human beings are unbroken and deserve to be unbreakable? And who are those subjects who have historically enjoyed that fantasy and created all kinds of violences to support it? And in some ways, I would say that this is a very white fantasy, this fantasy of intactness and of unbrokenness. So one of the things that I try to talk about in the book is how the fear that we have about approaching states that are intense is also the fear about being overwhelmed. And I quite paradoxically argue for the transformational possibilities of becoming overwhelmed rather than guarding the self and trying to prevent having too much feeling, like living a more aseptic and anemic life as a number of social forces want us to, such that we do not encounter anything new about ourselves or each other.
And I mean, the resistance to that is a fairly well-established psychoanalytic fact, but also more broadly just a fact of human nature, I think, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And it works well for a variety of different conservative forces. Capitalism works excellently. Like, it's easier to go on Amazon and buy things than to be present with one's experience. And I one of the surprising things that I'm saying is that some types of thinking, the ones that are most dominant right now about trauma, not only in psychoanalysis, but also in other clinical domains, are very allied with that project of shutting us down from ourselves, even as they don't think of themselves as such, and have become quite conscripted to like the neoliberal logics of offering us fantasies of perfection, of perfect restoration, or being able to return to some pre-traumatized self. I mean, that never happens. Like, nobody, I've never seen a patient get cured of their trauma. None of my colleagues have. That doesn't mean that things cannot be done vis-a-vis trauma, but One of the big claims in the book is that we need to become less preoccupied with what to do about trauma and to become more interested in what people do with their trauma.
That makes complete sense to me. I guess from the psychoanalytic standpoint, why are people drawn to their trauma? Even when they're sort of drawn to it in a way where they're trying to get rid of it, there's obviously still some kind of magnetism or attraction there, irrespective of what outcome they're trying to achieve. So what are the processes driving that?
There's a couple of different reasons. The first is that we are, in the psychoanalytic theory that I work with in this book, we are constituted through trauma. We come into being through being exposed to things as infants that are beyond our understanding and that have to do with what others bring to us, which is beyond what we can master or process developmentally or psychically. So our life starts out with this strange tangle between trying to make sense and to some degree making sense of some things, and then always playing catch up with that which is in excess of what we can manage that comes to us from the other. You might say, now this is a very different model, I should clarify, from thinking that we are born intact and then something traumatic happens that interrupts us and injures us, and therefore there was a pre-traumatic self. Rather, this way of thinking starts out with a premise that it is the very fact of this intrusion, necessary and inevitable intrusion by the other, which developmentally we can never manage, that puts in motion the whole process by which you end up developing a self and developing an unconscious and developing parts of who you, kind of like how you come to feel, to have a home in yourself. So if we start with a premise that trauma is, you know, the originating condition of how we come to be who we are, then the question is less about how do you get rid of it, but it's impossible to extract it from the psyche. But in some way, like that sits at the epicenter of your being. And there are, when we're not anesthetized by the multiple stimuli in our lives, the multiplicity of what's going on around us, which tells us to not think and to not be present, we yearn, we are drawn to make contact with parts of ourselves that are quite opaque to us. And there's something both exhilarating and frightening about that kind of contact. And that opacity, that constitutional sense of not quite the things we don't know about ourselves, that we can never know, that always exceed us, are, as I was just describing, very much threaded through trauma. So any new experience of trauma that we have, that is not ontological, but contingent, meaning like some people undergo traumatic experiences of violence or of rape or ongoing microaggressions that basically lead up to macroaggressions, or cumulative effects of small T trauma that eventually kind of like accumulates to capital T trauma. All of these end up having some connection with the originary trauma that we had, such that they both wound us, but they also become folded into, they develop some proximity with the originary trauma. So making contact with that trauma is also the place where we feel most alive. So think, for example, about kind of like two people who have undergone a traumatic experience together, even a traumatic experience that one may have undergone with somebody who inflicted the trauma on them, creates a particular kind of intimacy, which can be very strange. And I say the word intimacy not to say that it's good or to diminish the harm. There are varieties of connections, including connections that are forced upon us, that forge intimacies between people that can be very difficult, but also very powerful. And this is perhaps at some point, if we end up talking about Slave Clay or the Night Porter, we might think a little bit about that.
Yeah. Yeah. One question that sort of comes up for me from that is with the unknown self, is that the result of repression, or is it that there is some innate part of us that is always unknowable to us?
That's an excellent question, especially coming from somebody who's not a psychoanalyst. You're like, that's exactly the right question. Because there's always a part of us that we will never know, that has never been known to us, and we will never know. And the point is not to try to know it, but there's something about being in its proximity or in its presence. These are experiences of the uncanny that we may sometimes have, experiences of the sublime, being before something that feels like it's too big for us. It's of us, but it's not from us. And we can become very curious about these kinds of experiences, very drawn to them, very exhilarated by them. And they can also be quite frightening, or at times make us feel like we want to recoil.
And I mean, that's why I like your work so much, because it's so embracing of that risk factor, I guess. I listened to another interview with you, and you sort of described approaching trauma in this particular way in relation to sex. You were almost encountering the most uncoated version of sexual drive as there can be. And I really liked that as a way of articulating it. It feels quite validating to me, because that's sort of how I move through the world. I like to be at the edges. But for someone that sort of approach might not feel as instinctual for, can you make the case for engaging with trauma and sexuality in that way?
Well, one could, but I wouldn't. I think that this is not about pushing anybody or pressing anybody, or certainly not forcing anybody to engage with that. I think that this joy exists in all of us, but who is willing to tarry in that interval and who is more cautious about stepping into that domain, these are things that need to be respected. If anything, it's not about talking anybody into it. More than anything, it's about seduction. And I use seduction here in the psychoanalytic sense of not of misleading somebody or tricking somebody, but oftentimes we go to places that we might have not gone under other circumstances because we feel enticed by a relationship or enticed by a person or enticed by a part of ourselves that we are in some almost non-consensual relationship with. And that's one of the big roles that consent plays in this book, to say that risking these kinds of states and these kinds of experiences does not happen without consent. And here by consent, I don't mean to imply that it happens non-consensually, like somebody's forced or something is done against one's will, but to say that I talk about consent as something that also is also an internal experience, not just an interpersonal one, that to some degree in the encounter with something opaque in ourselves, something that excites, but also that thrills, but also kind of like make us feel like we want to close up. If one is to step into that territory and take the risk, it happens at the border of the ego's consent. It has to be wrested from ourselves every time. And again, I'm talking about the internal relationship that we have with this encounter with something unexpected or something surprising. Like, safety can do all kinds of important things in a relationship, and it is necessary. We need to feel safe. But transformational experiences are not a result of safety. Transformational experiences only arise in the friction zone with something one did not anticipate, in the riptide of the drive, the riptide of the sexual.
Yeah, I like that way of putting it. And I think this is kind of a good point to transition into talking about consent more broadly. So I wanted to start by talking a bit about affirmative consent and sort of your views around the shortcomings of it. I've interviewed a few people on the show now that have talked about the issues with affirmative consent, but I think you go a little bit further than some of the people that I've spoken to do, in the sense that you are introducing this idea of limit consent, and you're actually starting to build not quite a framework, but almost an idea of how people could behave, which I thought was really interesting. So can you take us through the issues of affirmative consent as you see them?
Sure. Let me first say that it is very important to remember that affirmative consent is something that the feminist movement has fought for very, very hard, and that there's a reason why it's been so vociferously defended and why it has been necessary. But with these gains in place, not that they are in place, and I mean, they're being fought over all the time, but even with, let's even take an imaginary society where kind of like affirmative consent has been established, that there are certain very, very important issues with the way in which affirmative consent imagines a subject who is transparent to herself, who knows what she wants, what she does not want, and who then is able to chart ahead of time the parameters of whatever sexual encounter she might have with another. It demands in our communications, affirmative consent, that is, demands in our communications kind of like a kind of linear, clear, crisp exchange. But this is not how psychic time works. Oftentimes, you don't know if you want something until after you've started experiencing it. And then by that time, it's too late to withdraw your consent. Like, for example, this happens in the clinic all the time. Like, legally, patients are required to consent to treatment. Otherwise, you can't treat patients again to their consent. But the truth is that however careful one tries to be, a patient, any of us, do not know what we're getting into when we enter an encounter with another. So I speak in the book, I give the example of a patient who came to see me, found herself very interested in working with me after the first meeting, and then asked me about my fee. I told her my fee. She told me she could pay it financially, she could afford it, but she didn't want to. And she felt quite upset that she now felt that she had been tricked by me, that if she had known my fee ahead of time, which she had not asked about on the phone. If she had known, she said to me, she would never have come to see me. And she would not now be finding herself in the very uncomfortable position of wanting to work with me and having to pay me this amount that she otherwise would not have paid. So, you know, it's a very interesting conundrum, because this patient did not want to leave. She did feel that I had, and this is her word, that I had screwed her. But she did not want to leave. What she wanted to do was for me to acknowledge that I had screwed her. And she was, part of what I say in the book is that she was not right, because I was not trying to screw her or trick her, but she was also not wrong in the sense that our encounter opened up an appetite in her for something from me, something she felt she could get from me, that she hadn't, that an appetite that was not aroused before our contact. And in that sense, kind of like, what could I have possibly said to her ahead of time for her to have affirmatively consented? Could I have said, you know, you may come in and find out that you want to work to me too much and you will not want to pay the amount that it will cost? How exactly do we imagine we could have anticipated that ahead of time? Like, a patient says, kind of like, is this the kind of thing that could hurt me? Like, I don't know. Like, any treatment will cause some pain. Is it going to be too much? You will only know when you get there. By that time, it's too late to withdraw your consent. So psychic life does not run on this chronological timeline. So that's kind of like the temporal frame of consent is all off. The other thing that I would say about consent is that it imagines, I think quite problematically, that there's one person with power, all the power, who kind of like presents the conditions of kind of like whatever the contract, so to speak, of the encounter will be. And the other person who has no power needs all the information in order to make an informed decision. Even if we put aside the issues of temporality that we're talking about just now, what is this condition? There's very few conditions in life where one person has all the power. Even if we talk just about positional power, there's all kinds of others, powers that have to do with who feels vulnerable to whom, who needs what from whom. So part of the pressure that I try to put on the concept of affirmative consent is to say that the perspective of one person possesses the information that needs to be shared, and the other person and proposes a contract that the other person agrees to or not, misunderstands the multiple layers of vulnerability that occur in the encounter between two people. So one of the examples that I bring up in the book is a play sequence between a mother and a child.
I love that analogy. It's so beautiful.
in that story, the mother is playing with the child. The child has a certain game in mind. The game is that the mother will scare her. When she says stop, the mother will stop. They play that back and forth again and again and again for a few times. And then the little girl says, we'll play a different game. I'll tell you to stop, but you won't stop. So I never say in the book what the mother decides to do, but I take that as an opportunity to think a little bit about what is the girl asking, and what would it mean for the mother to participate in that new contract, so to speak. The idea that, so we begin to see that in this kind of situation, if the mother is going to play along, she will also have to relinquish a couple of different things. First of all, her wish to keep her daughter safe. The safest thing to do is to not play this game. If she's going to play this game, she knows that there's a risk that something could go wrong, right? So she will have to take the risk of entering a game with unpredictable effects. Now, you may say she shouldn't play this game, which is fine. But what I'm trying to say is that if she's going to play it, all of a sudden, this either or of consent, of power of consent, begins to fray. And the other thing that you will have to kind of, the other risk that you will have to take is that if she hurts her daughter, she's also going to be hurt. Like, she's also going to be losing sleep over that. So she has to take a couple of different risks. And I begin to flesh out this type of consent by calling it limit consent, which rather than a consent that is about negotiating safety, limit consent is about beginning to negotiate around the limits of what it means not to stay safe, but to take a risk with each other.
Mm. One question that I had that's sort of coming up around that, and I'm going to try and phrase this as tidily as I can, thinking on the spot about it. Obviously, what you're describing there is a more empowering framework for both parties, right? Because there's sort of a mutual responsibility and culpability, I guess. Do you feel that there is some link between the sort of trauma obsession that you describe and the disempowering nature of how we have framed affirmative consent, where there is someone with power and someone without? Is there a link there?
Yeah, I think that's a great question. Let me qualify this by saying first that, you know, consent violations happen. So I can understand the need for it. And people do get traumatized over boundaries being crossed that they had never wanted to be crossed. That said, we have become so scared and so panicked about trauma in general that the possibility that a bad experience will ensue in a well-meaning encounter between two people because something got out of hand, because somebody didn't read the other person well. It's like we're kind of like hijacked by that and immobilized. So stepping into that territory does require, as you very rightly pointed out, however asymmetrical the situation might be, as all situations are, there's like it's a very rare situation to have symmetry of power in an encounter. However asymmetrical the situation might be, there is a degree of responsibility that both members carry into this kind of encounter when we're talking about adults and when we're not talking about relationships of care. You know, sometimes kind of like I had a patient once, I mentioned this case in the book, who inquired about whether, how likely was it that they were going to be hurt by the treatment. And the answer is, it depends what you mean by hurt, because a treatment that goes deep enough will raise some difficult things. And paradoxically, it's part of my job to actually create the conditions for that to be possible. Right? Which it's a very strange way to think about care, but it is a very important facet of care. So is it reasonable to be having a conversation with this patient about whether they can consent to the kind of pain that it will be caused to them? Well, theoretically, yes, but practically, like, good luck with that. Like, what exactly are you going to be kind of like disclosing? You yourself don't know how it's going to play out. But what this means is that whereas the relationship between us is asymmetrical, and I have a responsibility for their well-being, that is my duty, and they don't have a responsibility for my well-being. This is also not a situation of a mother and a child who walks into, who is completely dependent on a parent. And this is not to license the violations that can and do sometimes happen in treatments. It's only to say that human relationships are much more complex and cannot be legislated on the level of, by drawing these firm lines. And if you do legislate them that like that, what you miss out on, this is one of the big points in the book, is the intensity of experience at the core of one's being. Part of what can happen when you don't say things that are in the books or in workshops, or when you don't relate to each other according to how we're told, like, a woman is supposed to relate to a man, or how a trans woman is supposed to relate to a cis person, the room opens up for intimacy in a way that is not safe, but which can be incredibly deep in an entirely different way.
Mm. I want to think about this in a few different contexts, right, to see how it sort of plays out. Where I thought it might be interesting to start is in the area of sort of BDSM and kink, because obviously there's all sorts of different consent frameworks that have been developed as part of those communities, like safe, sane, consensual, or RAC, risk-aware, consensual kink, which have all been, you know, debated at length for their sort of strengths and weaknesses. I was sort of curious about how you would see those models fitting within this. Yeah, how it relates to limit consent, I guess.
I think that limit consent would be much more compatible with thinking with the RAC model than the SSC model, which also feels like a very defensive model to me. And I'm certainly not the only one to be saying that. Like, this whole idea of, like, safe, sane, and consensual is, Laura Antonio has like a really good way of phrasing it somewhere. She says, it's like, how would it sound if the gay movement's motto was not after your kids? what does it mean to be leading with a negation of, like, we know that this is what you're afraid of and this is not what we are? So the parallel that she's drawing there is that to have the emblem of the kink movement being, we are safe, we're sane, and we're not raping or abusing each other, is more about speaking back to the fears directed at the kink community, and probably also existing within the kink community as a result of these anxieties, rather than speaking to what the community is about. But you see, even in spaces like kink, where there are well-developed protocols for how to engage sexual experiences that play with risk, that play with trauma, that kind of like move on the edge of something intense happening and actually chase that edge, the anxiety about consent is tremendous. Even though there's also ways in which the kink community, some aspects of kink communities make a lot of room for errors and for the ways in which things can go awry between two people without necessarily assuming bad intent. And one of the points that I tried to make in the book, not specifically about the kink community, but would apply there too, is that entering the domain of limit consent, where there is an understanding that there is some risk that is engaged, requires an ethical kind of sadism. And I juxtapose that sadism, you were speaking about the kink community, to stay with that for a second, with the very as if mimetic and ultimately infirm sadism in the kink community, where it's a playful but also not kind of like solidly sovereign sadism. So we have, as a culture, been quite terrified about thinking about sadism. Sadism has not enjoyed the same level of critical attention as masochism has. There's been so many books written about masochism, trying to nuance the concept, trying to complexify the concept. Sadism has kind of like really lagged behind in thinking about it critically. So at the moment, we have like two major kind of like streams of thinking. The one is just coming from BDSM theory, and it's this form of kind of like, I'm the sadist, but kind of like, I'm the big bad wolf, and you're going to say no. And like, okay, but I'm not the big bad wolf. So, you know, it's kind of like very as if and very playful, and it kind of like loses its proximity to sadism versus what we think about as sadism in everyday life, which is this kind of like notion of destructive, really person obliterating, hurtful, intentionally damaging sadism. And we need a way of being able to think about how people move into these spaces of limit consent, taking both the risk and the responsibility of being the person who is entering these spaces, knowing kind of like that power is not either or, but also taking responsibility for the asymmetry in the relationship.
Mm. Yeah. And I mean, I think the thing that comes up for me when you're talking about that is that obviously there's degrees of trust that have to be foundational to that in order for it to function. So the other context that I was curious to hear your thoughts on how it would play out is more casual contexts or in a one night stand, or where there's not that foundation of knowing and trust, can limit consent kind of function in those spaces, or how would it ideally function in those spaces, I guess?
This is an excellent question. And I would start with saying, before we go to the more casual, every kind of like less weighted encounters, I would say that the kind of sadism that I'm talking about is an ethical kind that respects the other's subjectivity and which recognizes the vulnerability also of the sadist, and in the sense that the sadist is in a vulnerability. The risk that the sadist takes is not just with the other person's safety, it's also with oneself. If we go back to the example of the mother and the child, if the mother steps into that space of that game, she would be the sadist. She's going to be the one who's disrespecting her daughter's no, as her daughter asked her to. But she also has to manage something in herself to be able to do that, right? So I want to go to your question, though, about kind of like the question of trust. I think that your question is very important because it points to something that is very tricky, which is that one could say, well, maybe you need enough affirmative consent to build a relationship of trust so that you can then risk something. And that is definitely the case in some situations. In fact, in this example with a child and the mother, I say exactly that. She's listened to her so precisely. The mother has listened so precisely every time she said stop that now the girl can afford to wanting to invite her into something else that's more risky. But I also talk in the book about another kind of encounter, about Tim Dean, this queer theorist who writes about his experience of following this stranger. He's in a gay bar, in a leather bar. Tim Dean talks about having been a piss top for a while, having enjoyed the experience of piss play, but never having bottomed. And this guy takes him to the back. And as Tim Dean is basically giving him a blowjob, he realizes that this guy's pissing in his mouth. They have not discussed it. There's been no affirmative consent. This guy has really taken a risk. You could say this guy's violating him. But that is not how Tim Dean experiences it. In fact, he says that the moment he realized that this guy was, he said he describes in this paper, which is called The Art of Piss, he describes having felt the warm fluid and realizing, wow, this guy's like pissing in my mouth. And then paradoxically, he names having had the most spectacular orgasm ever. And he has this beautiful line, I think very moving line, where he says, that night, this man, the stranger, gave me the gift of erotic astonishment. Now, that gift of erotic astonishment is not conditioned by safety. it happens unexpectedly, perhaps it comes unbidden and likely courted by either of them. It just arrives precisely at the juncture of a non-consensually negotiated experience, which is also not a violation. And the tricky part is, one of the many tricky parts is that if Tim Dean had stood up and said, "How dare you? Like, I never said you could piss in my mouth," I would certainly not be blaming him for this. I would be saying, I get it. Like, if he said I was traumatized, like I was just giving this guy a blowjob and all of a sudden he's pissing in my mouth, I feel violated, I would say, I get it. I understand it. And when he says, "But this was an erotically astonishing experience," I understand that too. And that is precisely the risk of limit consent. The risk is that you don't know how it's going to go until after the fact. But the responsibility of the ethical sadist is to stick around and bear the responsibility of what he has provoked, even as he's not guilty for it. Guilt is not the same thing as provocation. So does the stranger, if Tim Dean had gotten really upset and he had freaked out, would the stranger have a responsibility for that? Absolutely. Absolutely, he would have a responsibility for that. And this is part of, so you might say, like, so this, here's an example where you have like a really casual scene, right? It's a pickup scene. It's not even a negotiated scene. And it happens to go really well. Nobody's traumatized. Nobody's upset about it. It could have gone in a very different direction. But part of what I'm trying to say is that trust may or may not have something to do with it.
Mm, yeah. And I mean, that's a very radical kind of concept, which I, you know, it's provocative and I love it, but it is definitely a radical one. I mean, what you're raising there is that people have an intuitive sense of what is ethical for them and what is not ethical for them, I guess.
Perhaps, not necessarily. Like another example, here's an example of something that is very, very negotiated and very affirmative, but which goes in the opposite direction. Like I start the book with the example of a patient of mine who has really negotiated a sexual encounter with her lover, with her female lover. And the encounter is a slap. And her partner slaps her. And my patient says to me, "This slap was so much more than what I expected. It was the right force, the right part of my face, the right expression on her face. I didn't expect an exquisite slap. I expected a really mediocre slap." And she's safe words, not because the other person violated her, but because the very thing that they negotiated turned up to be so much more than what she expected, that she cannot bear that in herself. So she stops this scene, not because the other person crossed her limits, but because the experience that the encounter with this other person produced crossed her own internal limits, even as the other person didn't violate them. So here you have kind of the opposite example, like affirmative consent is there, but the unexpected arises, and this particular individual is unable to give herself over to the surprise and to the excitement and the thrill and the sizzle that comes from that moment. And what she does instead is she recoils. I wish I could lean or trust that there's something intuitive. We all know in some sense, and we just need to be in touch with our intuition. But I think that there are so many more factors that go into these kinds of experiences. Like, this happened to be a really exquisite experience, and that's not what she thought she was signing up for. She wanted something more manageable. So you see, like, these are all different and surprising and unusual examples, but telling examples of how affirmative consent falls short and how much more complicated the scene of the erotic is.
Mm. So you propose this concept of overwhelm in the book and describe it in a really wonderful way. So could you take me through your definition of overwhelm?
Mm-hmm. Well, I was referencing earlier in our discussion, this came up in relation to how in the effort to protect ourselves from becoming traumatized, we've taken it as a given that if one is to become overwhelmed, that's a bad thing. And the unexpected position that I take in this book is that overwhelm is something that can also crack open the more established and perhaps calcified parts of ourselves to allow something new to happen. And that, again, will not happen with the ego's consent, meaning that we will resist something cracking open in us, even as we may yearn for it or may enjoy it or appreciate it after the fact. And that there are experiences where something becomes more and more intense, where we become overwhelmed, and give a couple of examples in the book of clinical cases. And kind of like I talk about my own experience of overwhelm with a play that I became quite transfixed and obsessed by, to show how experiences of becoming overwhelmed, if not stopped, but allowed to escalate. And if one throws oneself into these kinds of experiences, something can really become transformed in one's sense of oneself, one's relationships with others, rather than guarding the self and trying to preserve the self so that nothing gets challenged. These kinds of overwhelm, like the rupture of the ego, the shattering of the self, can put oneself in the presence of the drive, in the presence of the opacity of the sexual, in a way that can be not only meaningful, not only turn out to be meaningful after the fact, but really enlarge the scope of experience, open one up to feeling things differently, experiencing things at a different level.
Mm. That makes sense to me. I think one important thing that you touch on in the book is sort of the differentiation between overwhelm and dysregulation. And you talk about sort of, unlike malignant dysregulation, overwhelm is a driven state that issues from within an attuned dyad. So I liked this idea of the attuned dyad. Can you explain what that means and how you think about the difference between dysregulation and overwhelm?
Yeah, I think that part of that also connects with the question that you had earlier about affirmative consent. To go back to the piss play example, even though this was a stranger, we can assume that enough was well enough matched between these two men that there was not a tremendous amount of fear that something harmful could be done. Enough for Tim Dean to follow the stranger to the back of a dimly lit room and put his penis in his mouth and start giving him a blowjob, right? In therapeutic fields, and psychoanalysis in particular, there's a lot of concern about dysregulation. Like, what if the patient gets dysregulated? We need to make sure that the patient is regulated. What if, kind of like, what happens in patients' relationships with their parents, with their partners? Dysregulation is treated as an index of something going wrong. But what if some of these dysregulations are also indications that something is opening up or something is becoming intensively engaged in ways that one might not feel comfortable with or might look bizarre or strange from the outside? What if we became a little bit less traumatophobic and rather than try to shut these states down, we allowed them to escalate to their magnificent intensities, to the extent that they might break something down in the self. And when I say we allow, I'm talking about ourselves. I'm not talking about trying to do that to another person. Even an ethical sadist does not do this to anyone. They provide the conditions for that to become possible, but it's not about imposing it on somebody.
Mm. And I mean, one thing that came up for me when I was sort of reading your description of overwhelm was sort of, again, to relate it back to kink community, the idea of sort of subspace, and that what I've heard described of that felt sort of like there were similar currents through it. Would you agree with that, that it's sort of an almost like an altered headspace?
It's definitely an altered headspace. And in keeping with what I'm saying also about ethical sadism, I think it also has to do with top space, not just bottom space, not just subspace, kind of like these altered states that kind of like some people in the in their aftermath describe having been transformed by them, not just having a very intense experience. For some people, it's just a very intense experience, and that's fine. But some people feel really altered by these experiences. And when these experiences are endured together with another person, in the presence of another who's also undergoing an experience of this sort, the intimacy that can develop in these spaces is of a very different order. To have stepped into the fray together, and to have been in that intense vibration together, can leave people feeling very, very connected to each other, but not necessarily in the sense of closeness or a bond, even though that too might happen, but as having undergone something together in a way that can be extremely meaningful.
Yeah, I mean, in one point you're sort of talking about the word perversion and sort of your preference to it over other words like kink or things that sort of often surround that space, because it sort of encompasses the transgressive more sufficiently. And you talk about this idea of inter-embodied processes within that, or sort of this somatic communication that is without language. Like, that's something that's very appealing to me, that there's this space where sort of language isn't sufficient, and that there's something that is bigger than that.
Another reason why affirmative consent fails.
Mm. Yeah. Yeah. No, I very much sort of felt that. And I like how you then tie that into sort of feeling a sense of wonderment. So can you describe the link between those two things, from sort of perversion to wonderment? Might sound like two very juxtaposing kinds of ideas, but can you kind of explain how one potentially gives rise to the other?
Yeah, I mean, potentially is a key word here, of course, because, you know, there are no recipes for these kinds of experiences. And in fact, the more one tries to have them, the less likely one surrenders to whatever current might move one there. But key to perversion, and to also some of the aesthetic experiences that I talk about in the book, is their intensity. Their intensity with Hatch to do with both kind of like the physical intensity, but also the intensity between people, the fact that they can feel bombarding in the sense that they become overwhelming. And it is precisely because they become overwhelming that they can kind of like bring one to that state of like the shattering of the self and the transformational experiences that we were talking about earlier. So in some ways, the book is very much an argument for reconsidering our relationship to intensity and our fear of intensity, I think, facile conviction that intensity necessarily means trauma, even though there's no question that intensity can be re-traumatizing in some way, and to become curious about the ways in which people dabble in the domain of traumatic experience. And when I talk about race play in the book, I kind of like make a beeline for one of the most difficult traumas to talk about, especially right now in America, which is racial trauma.
Yeah. Can you talk a little bit more about what you say about sort of racial trauma and its links to slavery and how that plays out?
I mean, I work with a variety of different materials in the book. I work with Jeremy O'Harris's play called Slave Play. I work with an interview that I had with a Black race play activist, and also with some materials from Melina Williams's documentary and interviews. Melina Williams and the Black activists I interviewed are both kind of like pioneers in the race play movement. And these are like a race play, for listeners who are not familiar with it, is a particular kind of niche edge fetish, which is very established in queer in kink communities, where it is also controversial, which involves the the play with racial stereotypes and the use of racial expletives as part of sexual play. And it's perverse in the ways that I use the word perversion in the book to talk not about pathology, but to talk about intense erotic, pursued erotic excitements that kind of like are both scripted and repetitive. And I work with race play because I think that contrary to many other erotic interests, it is so challenging and it poses so many important questions about the entwinement of the gnarled entwinement of racial trauma and racial violence with sexual experience, that if you're not going to dismiss it outright and start saying that people should not be doing that, as is certainly done by kind of like in this domain, then you're going to have to think beyond the platitudes and the habits of our thinking to try to understand what might be happening. What do we make of desires that syndicate something extremely historically injurious and which is blistering through the present, in the sense that, of course, racism still exists in our everyday, and which now appears in a heated way entwined with sexual life. And so I track these examples to argue that there are many ways to understand human agency. And there are many ways in which we treat traumatized subjects, and especially subjects of color, as having restricted agencies on account of their trauma, and do not permit that agency arises in different and at times unexpected and bizarre forms. And I use the example, there's a quote from Mike Bond, one of them. People, the person that I interviewed for this book, who approaches me to talk about race play, and he wants to speak with me. He gives me an interview, and he's describing about how in the BDSM scene, there's not much critique against rape play. He actually describes a scene that he walks into in a BDSM club where a man has written, he says, every misogynistic slur on a woman's body in a scene that is negotiated, and it's a public rape play scene. And he says to me, but nobody stops the scene to run in and ask him if he has anger issues, or to talk to her about feminism, and to ask her if her mother is okay with this. But when I would do a race play scene in a public space, he says, like, I cannot do that without people coming up to me and talking to me about racism, talking to me about how they should not have to watch this. Like, do I have a note from my pastor or my ancestors? Are my ancestors okay with me doing race play? And he says something really striking. He says that he says, I am not in the dungeon for my civil rights. I am in the dungeon for my boner justice rights. Which is a really interesting way of showing how the erotic is embroiled with justice, not in the domain only of rights or dignity, but that paradoxically also arises through the resource, in this case, of erotic humiliation. And here is one very powerful example of how we don't like to find trauma in sex. Sex needs to be cleaner, especially the kind of trauma that makes white people anxious because of our complicity, because of our ongoing engagement with racist practices and our ongoing benefiting of race from racism in everyday life.
Yeah, I mean, it's a very strong example around sort of a person's right to choose their subversion, I guess. And then how do you navigate with that within a public domain and a public space, which is a whole, you know, that's a whole nother podcast episode in and of itself. But I suppose where I kind of want to end things is on the note of your book feels like such a strong invitation to reconsider risk and notions of safety and all of these things. And so without being prescriptive, I wondered if you had any thoughts around how people can start to reconsider these concepts or play with them if that's something that they're curious about.
You know, I don't have anything to say about that other than the following. Anybody who's interested, anybody whose curiosity is piqued by these ideas, by this discussion, by this book, needs to kind of like think out something with themselves. I take it when I said to you earlier that this is not about getting anybody to do anything, that we have to respect people's preferences and defenses and where they feel safe. Like, I take that very seriously. If anybody wishing to explore these areas needs to do that of their own accord and of their own will. And the worst thing I think to do would be to try to do that as a recipe or as a when I say that it's not a how-to, I don't just mean this in the sense of don't do this at home. What I'm also trying to say is some really personal decisions and really personal risks that one takes with their whole self. So it can't be somebody else's idea or thought, except when it's an inspiration or a seduction in the way that we were talking about earlier. Certainly not as a recipe or a recommendation.
No, I like the idea of seduction a lot. And I think my even asking that question affirms your point that we have a desire to find answers. That's my own nature coming through there.
Thanks for listening to The Philosophy of Sex, and a huge thank you to Avie. Head to the show notes for more information about her book. I'm Caroline Moreau-Hammond. Thanks to Zoltan Fetcho for editing this episode and writing the music. If you like what you're hearing or have a question, please leave us a review or email us at info@becoming.me. Don't forget to subscribe if you don't want to miss any new episodes.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.